For the week of August 4th, 2013, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 200, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in Los Angeles, I'm Karen Woodward.
And in Birmingham, Alabama, I'm Michael. Wait, what? Karen?
Hi. How are you?
Wait, now this is a little strange because, Michael, when I said you should travel for episode 200, I didn't mean to Birmingham. I meant to maybe Hollywood or Los Angeles.
Yeah, one day we'll do it all together in L.A.
Yes.
But Karen's back here for the episode 200. Tell us what you're up to, Karen. Where are you working? What are you doing? How exciting is your life? How much do you miss us?
I miss you guys terribly. Let's start with the most important part. I miss you guys terribly. But I've been keeping busy doing social media for entertainment companies and, continuing to have absolutely no life except when I'm on Facebook and Twitter.
Well, by the way, I'm not sure if you know this, but there actually is no life besides when you're on Facebook and Twitter. That's what I've been told.
Well, that's true. And cats. Anything involving cats gives you life.
Right. Well, and Instagram. Instagram
of cats.
Ooh, yes. And possibly Yelp, but only when you're about to go out, which never actually happens. So
yeah,
therefore,
no,
Yelp.
No, I don't do that.
Yeah, Yelp doesn't matter.
Well, I hope that we won't have any conflicts between your clients and the stories we cover today. Sperling, what stories are we going to cover today? What's the first one?
Well, on today's show, we're going to be telling you what the most profitable property, Comcast, NBC, Universal. I don't know how many company names are in that the correct company name now. So I don't know if it's called Comcast or Comcast NBC.
Called Comcast NBC Universal.
Oh, okay.
She would know. And we're going to tell you what it looks like maybe their most valuable property ever turns out to be. Is it E.T., Back to the Future, Jaws? We'll let you know.
Yes, I think you're going to be surprised by that, by the way. We'll also be telling you how Hollywood studios have been stiffed by China. That's right, an entire country has not paid Hollywood. Speaking of getting stiffed, Time Warner Cable and CBS, they're having a little retransmission dispute, which is getting quite serious. The cable provider has blacked out all CBS channels on its service, leaving me without any PGA golf over the weekend.
Or the number one show in the country, Under the Dome.
That's true. Yes. We'll end by telling you about musician Amy Mann. She's in a licensing lawsuit, which actually could have some big implications for the industry. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines. And we'll close with some inside baseball, as I just mentioned, with Amy Mann. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And the number one movie around the world is Smurfs 2, the sequel to The Smurfs. It grossed $70 million worldwide. It opened in Wednesday here in North America and a few other places. So its grand total so far is $80 million and counting.
And yet it is seen as a huge disappointment here in the U.S. because it opened, I guess, what, $15 million lower than the first one?
That's right. Usually a sequel will build on the original. That's the idea. These days, and Smurfs 2 opened pretty low, is in third place in North America, a weak opening here. But, you know, it tripled its budget overseas, the first movie. It made about $140 million in the U.S. and another $520 million overseas. So they're hoping the same thing will happen this time, and it looks like they might, because it made $18 million in the U.S. and $52 million overseas, which is almost exactly triple what it made in North America. So the ratio is still holding up. Obviously, they like to make $100 million or $150 million, but if they can triple the U.S. box office, they might be okay.
I don't see how you go from $20 million to $150 million in the U.S., but that's another story.
Well, right. Why would an animated film do so well overseas? Because it's a cartoon and it travels well?
Yes, because they dub it.
They do the local voices, and the Smurfs is a worldwide property. It started in the Scandinavia, right?
No. It started in France and Belgium.
Oh, Belgium.
I did not know
that's
that.
Right.
I thought it was USA, born and bred.
No, it's a Belgium property. So there you go. The number two movie around the world is The Wolverine, the latest in the Wolverine saga. It grossed $60 million worldwide. It's at $255 million and counting. And number three, another big disappointment, is Pacific Rim. That made another $58 million. It's just under $300 million worldwide. It still hasn't even scraped its way to $100 million in the U.S., and it's almost completely off the charts. Overseas, it's made $200 million. So $300 million worldwide, it costs $200 million to make and a lot more to market. So this is a long way to not being in the red. At number four.
And I find that interesting because the nerd boys that I know who saw that movie loved it.
Wait, you know nerd boys?
I know plenty of nerd boys.
Okay.
Well, you know, it didn't really get great reviews. Some nerd boys liked it. Some didn't. I thought it was okay. But, you know, it really needs to do tremendously well in Asia to sort of get into the black. And it doesn't look like it's going to do it. Certainly, we won't be seeing Pacific Rim 2 unless something bizarre happens. At number four around the world is Two Guns, the action thriller starring Mark Wahlberg and Denzel Washington, or depending on your point of view, Denzel Washington and Mark Wahlberg. It opened very strongly in North America to $27 million. It's got nice little B-movie reviews. All the reviews said, hey, it's a fun little movie. It's original. It's fresh. It's not, you know, a sequel. We're happy.
Well, wait a second. Are we going to see a sequel of this that we could call it Three Guns or Four Guns or Two Plus Two?
It sounds like a sequel already, but it's not. And it is, of course, one of the few movies that is original. In North America, the Wolverine, The Smurfs 2, Despicable Me 2, Grown Ups 2, Red 2, five out of the top 10 movies are all sequels. And Pacific Rim and Two Guns, they feel like one.
But that speaks to what the movie industry is like right now, doesn't it?
Ooh. It's always the way the movie industry is. You know, they made a sequel to King Kong. They released it within 6 months of the original. Well, they've always made tons of sequels.
Let's hold that thought, because we'll actually be joined by Mr. George Clooney later, who will...
We wish.
Yeah. I think he's running for office, by the way. That's what it sounds like. Number five around the world is The Conjuring, the horror film that got very good reviews for what it is. It made $25 million worldwide. It's at $137 million and counting. It only cost $20 million. So this weekend alone, it equaled its budget. This movie is the kind of movie Hollywood loves. No big stars, cheap to make, and makes a lot of money. At number six around the world, Despicable Me 2. That's a film from the Universal NBC Comcast world. Or is it Comcast NBC Universal? That movie is grossed $24 million this weekend and $713 million worldwide. It's a monster hit. More about that in a minute. At number seven, Snowpiercer. This made $19 million. It opened up in South Korea. It's another Korean hit. That market is on fire. It keeps putting movies in the top 10, but unlike some of the other Korean films, we may actually see this one. In fact, we will, because it's the English language debut of director Bong Joon-ho, who did the very fun monster flick The Host, which I liked a lot. This movie is like an 80% English. It stars Chris Evans from Fantastic Four, Jamie Bell, Tilda Swinton, Ed Harris, along with major Korean stars, or to put it another way, it stars Jamie Bell.
Oh, wow.
It's got a very similar plot to Elysium, the Matt Damon film that's about to open up. It's about a future world in which everything is clad in snow and the only left survivors live on a train that keeps circling the globe. They can't get off the train. And the rich people live in the front cars and the poor people live in the back cars and they're getting sick of it. So that's the plot of the film. It made $19 million in South Korea, did very, very well its opening weekend there. And unlike some other South Korean films, this one will definitely make its way over to the U.S.
Does it end after it sinks upon hitting an iceberg?
Al Gore shows up and the whole thing falls apart.
Okay, just checking.
And number eight around the world is Red 2, the sequel to the old people can be in action films as well movie Red. It grossed another $15 million. It's at $76 million worldwide and counting. And number nine is the illusionist turned, you know, bank robbers called Now You See Me, starring Jesse Eisenberg. Another $13 million. It's at $233 million and counting. At number 10, the so-so DreamWorks film Turbo. It's at $126 million worldwide. It also made $13 million this weekend. Right behind it, another animated film, another sequel, Monsters University. It made $12 million. It's at $613 million and counting. At number 12 around the world, one of the big success stories of the summer, The Heat, the buddy cop comedy starring Melissa McCarthy, another $12 million. It's at $186 million and counting. It's a monster hit in North America where it's made $150 million. It's starting to open up overseas. It's made $37 million so far. Melissa McCarthy is a big star in North America. Maybe this is the movie to make her a big star everywhere else.
I told you that movie was good.
I love it.
I haven't. Yeah?
Oh, yeah.
What else? You liked it? You saw it? Fun, good, empowering?
I don't know if I would say fun, good, and empowering. It was fun.
Yeah.
I like Melissa McCarthy.
I've seen better movies, but I enjoyed myself.
I love Melissa McCarthy. I thought she was great on Gilmore Girls. And I feel like the movies she's making, she's just the big dumb slob. Like, she's the female John Belushi. And I find it embarrassing and sad because I think she's so talented.
But she does it so well. I mean, you can see her elevate the comedy off the page in this movie. Nobody can say a line like she can.
Right. And I have to say, there were moments in that film where it looked like Sandra Bullock was just watching going, what else are you going
to
do?
Yeah. How do you do that? Yeah. I mean, she stole the movie from Sandy Bullock and that's a hard thing to do.
At number 13 is the Adam Sandler film Grown Ups 2. That's at $137 million worldwide. At number 14 is another South Korean film. It's called The Terror Live. I have I have no idea what this movie is about, but it grossed $9.5 million in South Korea. It's sort of it's a cop thriller or a crime thriller film of some sort, but I don't know who stars in it or anything about it. World War Z with Brad Pitt is down below that. It's just about to hit $500 million worldwide. And then below that, Fast and Furious 6, it's at $770 million. And then Ripped, which is a big bomb everywhere in the world. And just out of that top little budget there, a couple movies. The Lone Ranger, that's proving to be as big a flop overseas as it was in North America. It's at $175 million worldwide. And then finally, I Love Wolfie 2. I Love Wolfie with two Fs. It took me a while to figure what this out. It opened in China. It made $5.1 million this weekend. So if it had opened up in North America, for example, it would have ranked around number 9. And it doesn't seem to be a sequel. It's an animated film in China, and it grossed $5 million. I can't find any evidence of I Love Wolfie. I think maybe China has figured out a way to just skip the boring process of making original films and jumped right to the sequel. That's what I think.
So wait a second. You're saying that in China, they will actually
just make the sequels.
Just copy something?
No, but maybe it's like X-Men and then the sequel. Not really a sequel, more like a spinoff.
But I looked at all the actors and I couldn't find them in any or other. Some of them were, a lot of them were only in this film. They're voice actors. It seems to be animated. It's called I Love Wolfie 2. I looked up the director and the leads. Almost none of them were in any other movies at all. So
maybe it's the animated version of Wolverine.
That's right. So back in North America, a couple notes on smaller films. The Way, Way Back is making a lot of money. It's at $13 million and counting. It's one of the big success stories in independent films.
That's one of my most favorite movies I've ever seen. Have you guys seen it?
Yes, I have.
Ever.
I loved it.
It was. Wow. It's a good movie. It's a
All right,
very
I'll
good
have to
movie.
Check it out.
And what I thought was interesting is that you have The Way, Way Back being released this summer. It appeared at Sundance. It was picked up there for, I think, I think it's $10 million. I don't know. I don't want to speak out of school. I don't know how much it was picked up for, but it was a lot. And you also have, and I'm blanking on the name of this.
Fruitvale Station.
Not Fruitvale. Well, yes, Fruitvale Station's also doing well. It was. It won Sundance and was picked up there.
That's at $10 million and counting.
And another fantastic movie.
And then you have The Spectacular Now, which also played at Sundance, was picked up there. And it got good reviews out of Sundance, and it's getting great reviews now.
Well, The Way, Way Back premiered at the Los Angeles Film Festival. Maybe it played Sundance, but it did premiere at the LA Film Festival, according to Wikipedia, at least. It was the closing night film.
Yes, this year, after it played at Sundance.
Oh, okay.
So it played at Sundance in the premiere section, and then...
How can it be a premiere, then?
It was the
LA Film Festival closes with premiere of The Way, Way Back. That's according to the LA Times.
The premiere for the release.
Okay. The premiere for the movie that's already been seen.
Yes.
Maybe it was just a North American premiere.
Yeah, sure. But, I can't find out how much it sold for at Sundance, but if it sold for $10 million, then they're losing money right now.
I want to say that they bought it for slightly less than Little Miss Sunshine.
Yeah. I mean,
that was a lot of money.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And another big film in limited release is the Woody Allen film Blue Jasmine. It grossed $2 million this weekend on only 50 screens. That's a $40,000 per screen average. If anyone can explain to me why out of all the mediocre movies in the last 20 years, suddenly Midnight in Paris and this one have exploded at the box office. I don't know why. If anyone
Especially
can explain
because
to
I
me,
hear this movie's terrible.
Well, I know people who like it or think Cate Blanchett is good. I mean, it's certainly got better reviews than most of his other recent movies. But for some reason, audiences are flocking. I guess a stopped clock is right twice a day. You know, if you make 20 movies, two of them will click.
Yeah.
But here's what happened to me. I went to see Fruitvale Station, and what I remember most is the ad I saw in front of the film. Of course, nowadays, we just accept the fact that there are 20 minutes of ads and another 15 minutes of trailers before we get to the darn movie. But anyway, I saw an ad. It was for Best Buy and Samsung. And yes. It was about a young woman just out of college, and the voiceover is describing what she's doing. We see her in an office space doing it, and it says she's just landed her first freelance gig, and her equipment is subpar, and she needs to spend money on a whole new range of toys, you know, a new laptop, a new smartphone, a new tablet, and she's at Best Buy, and the folks there are going to help her out. And then, of course, she does a great job, and she's there, and she's giving a presentation at work, and she gets a big round of applause, and the voiceover tells her to nail that freelancing gig. And I'm like, oh my God. That's what the dream is now, to get a freelancing gig when you get out of college.
Yeah.
That's the best people can hope for.
Yeah, no, I saw the same thing and had the exact same thought. I was like, what the hell are they advertising?
That's the most depressing thing I've ever seen. She's out of college. She just got a degree. If you're lucky, you'll get a freelancing gig and have to buy your own equipment.
Hey, but you know what? Don't knock it, though, because that generation wants that. They don't want to work for the man. They actually want to be free
agents. They're lucky because there ain't any jobs left.
No kidding.
Companies don't want employees anymore. So lucky them. They're born at the right time.
They not only get to buy their own equipment, they also get to buy their own health insurance.
That's right. So Sperling, those are the movies at the box office. Take us back to Despicable Me 2. What do we learn about that film this week?
Well, before we do that, the way, way back, $10 million purchase at Sundance.
Ouch. Let's see where it ends up. It's at $13 million. It should make, now an indie film, typically I would say if it really doubles its price, it's probably done well. We know that they're only going to get back half of it and they still have marketing costs, but they tend to be more, you don't need to make as much money to get into the black, I would think, as you would on a major studio release. Does that make sense? Usually
yes.
Marketing costs aren't as big. You're going to make more money, et cetera.
Right.
But so they're at 13 million. If they can get to 20 million, they might get lucky. Or if it works overseas, they'll get really lucky. Universal got lucky, didn't they?
Yes, with Despicable Me 2, as you mentioned, over $700 million. By the way, Karen, how do you like the fact that we don't do North American box office anymore? We do worldwide box office.
That's the way the movie industry is now.
Now, we've been doing this for well over a year, don't you think, Michael?
Yeah.
And have you noticed that everybody in the industry has followed us?
Yes, I've noticed that.
It's becoming more of a trend that they'll talk about the worldwide box office for Wolverine or the worldwide box office for The Lone Ranger and Pacific Rim. It seems to be catching on even in television and the regular media, not just Variety and Hollywood Reporter. It seems to be spreading more and more that this recognition, why would you just report on how a movie's doing in the South? You talk about all of North America.
Yeah,
so why
but
would
movies
you
are being made now for the entire world, not just for North America. That's because you can't afford to fund a movie otherwise. That's why movies are so bad right now.
Right.
That's right.
That's why I'm making a movie just for a single county in Alabama.
That's a great idea.
Yeah.
Birmingham Redux or something.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
But of course, Universal did make Despicable Me 2 on a dime. It was an animated film and a sequel. I don't know what kind of deal Steve Carell has, but I hope it includes points. And by that, I mean gross points, because it only costs $75 million to make.
Not market, but make. Yeah. So,
well, sure, it costs a lot to market. But what did they say this week?
They said that, I think it was the head of, what's his face? Steve Burke, the head of NBC Universal, Comcast, that big company.
Comcast, NBC Universal.
What she said. They said, hey, it's going to be the most profitable film in Universal history. Universal Pictures is 100 years old, and this is the most profitable film. Is it Jaws? Nope. Is it Jurassic Park? No. Is it E.T.? No. Not even Back to the Future or, none of those movies.
Dracula, Frankenstein. I mean, they have a long history.
Right. And it's Despicable Me 2.
Now, This brings up some interesting questions. Did you like the movie, Karen? Have you ever seen it or the original one?
You know how I feel about cartoons. No.
You mean animated movies?
Animated films, yes. No, I haven't seen it.
It was actually...
But those little minions are so cute.
Yes.
Well, they're going to have their spinoff film. That's the next one in the property. So the Minions get their own feature. I think that comes out in 2 years.
Is it going to be subtitled? I mean, they don't speak English. You can barely understand what they say.
Yes, it probably will be, because then it's perfect for international audiences.
Exactly. Like Cats, the musical. Everybody understood what was going on because there was very little dialogue. But yes, the Minions get their own movie, just like the Roadrunner. They didn't talk. They went beep, beep. They didn't need to talk. They just chased each other around.
Yes, but they always had dynamite that, so even there they had set pieces.
Now, think about this. They're saying this is their most profitable film of all time. And at 3 points in their history, they have had the film that's been the highest grossing movie of all time without adjusting for inflation. Jaws, when it came out, the highest grossing film of all time. E.T., when it came out, the highest grossing movie of all time. Jurassic Park, when it came out, the highest grossing movie of all time. And yet they say Despicable Me 2 will be the single most profitable film because it only cost, and I say only, in quotes, $75 million to make, and so far it's made like $700 million worldwide. So is this their most successful property of all time? That's the question we have to ask now. Think back to Jaws, Jurassic Park, E.T., Back to the Future, way back to Dracula and Frankenstein and Francis the Talking Mule. That was a big, you know, hit series for Universal. What is their most successful franchise of all time?
Is this an open book test? Because I'm looking at the show notes and I know what the answer is.
Well, no, it's not necessarily an answer. It's just an interesting thing to point out. But one thing is to point out is that Phantom of the Opera was made by Universal a couple times, but they did not have a piece of the Phantom of the Opera musical. That may be the single most valuable thing ever. It's grossed $6 billion worldwide at the theatrical box office, you know, in live theater. It doesn't even count the so-so movie. But there's E.T., Jurassic Park. How do you quantify that? Jurassic Park has had theme park rides and merchandising and three movies. I mean, that's an awfully successful franchise.
Yes. I would say
E.T., Jaws.
I would say E.T.
Except that didn't, I had tons of merchandising, but it didn't have any many spinoffs. So as far as a franchise that's generated movies and TV shows and things that you can keep making money on, you know, like a Star Wars is far more valuable than E.T., I would imagine.
Yes, I would agree.
Karen, have you been to Broadway? Have you seen a Broadway show or seen a Broadway show on tour? Have you taken your nieces or somebody to see Wicked?
I've seen Wicked myself.
Yes, you have.
Not on Broadway. I saw it here in L.A.
You're a woman, so you've seen Wicked. Wicked may be one of the most successful franchises of all time for Universal. They invested in the show, even though, of course, they didn't make The Wizard of Oz, on which it's inspired. It's based on a spinoff book, of course, by Gregory Maguire. And Wicked has grossed $3 billion worldwide. For that one single entity, like one movie, one TV show, one musical, that one musical in live theater has grossed $3 billion worldwide, which kind of puts Despicable Me 2 to shame.
That's so incredible. But it's also a lot more expensive to go see a musical, live theater. So don't we have to take that into account as well?
So what you're saying is more people may have seen, Jurassic Park, but they earn less money, whereas fewer people have seen Wicked, but they made more money because it costs more money to purchase a ticket to it.
What you're saying, it's also costs a lot to mount it, so you get to take home less money.
Okay, yeah. Fair enough.
You know, like Despicable Me made $700 million worldwide. They probably got maybe 40% of that back. Once you look at overseas, or even 35%.
Like, yeah, no, probably more like 50 when all
well,
is said
and done. They don't get 50 from overseas.
Right, but they get like 65 here. You know, where they'll get 60 here. So,
oh, I thought it was more like 50. So, all right. So they got $350 million so far. And yeah. Wicked, say if they only took back 50%, well, then they would be making $1.5 billion.
Yeah. Now, here's the thing. You know where they won't be making any money? Mm-hmm. In China. On Despicable Me 2, that is. And that is Universal Pictures will not be making any money on Despicable Me 2 in China because China said, hey, no, you can't release your movie here.
They only released like what, 20 movies?
No, they released 34 now. It's up from 20. So last year there was this big agreement that, I guess maybe we should just get into this whole China debacle, as I'd like to call it. Last year there was this, you know, the China finally started adhering to
the
world.
They said, we'll release more movies and we'll give you more of a cut of the box office. Because even if you released a movie in China, you only got back like 10% of what the movie made. And you had to do it through an official China company, and there was only one of them.
There's like two, but China Film Group is where you have to go. That's who you release your movie through. And China was kind of not adhering to the World Trade Organization agreement. They wanted to become a part of the World Trade Organization, and in 2009, they were supposed to not block media companies. Well, they waited until 2012 when they finally cut a deal with Christopher Dodd and Joe Biden, helping Christopher Dodd, the head of the MPAA, and Joe Biden being, you know, the vice president of the United States. They finally
thanks
cut
for clarifying.
Yeah,
I've heard of that guy.
Yeah.
They're not following the rule, but this has got nothing to do with that. They choose which films to release, and they're not choosing Despicable Me 2.
Right.
So it's not that they're not breaking that agreement or something. They've just decided this is not one of the 31 films from outside of China that we're going to release this year. And guess what they did release this year? I Love Wolfie 2. One of the reasons why they're not releasing Despicable Me 2 is because they don't want the competition. They want to release their own animated films, and they don't want a lot of Hollywood animated movies like The Droods, which did really well in China.
Don't you mean the Croods?
The Croods. Is it The Croods?
Yeah, apparently Michael doesn't like animated movies either.
I love animated movies. So they did not release Despicable Me 2, and they left the field wide open for I Love Wolfie 2, which opened this weekend. And that's one reason why Despicable Me 2 was not chosen, because they don't want animated films to suck up all the audience dollars.
Right.
Okay, well, but can we blame them for that? Because I don't think I do.
Well, I mean,
well, blame. Look, they'd be better off if they just allowed any movies to play that could.
Right.
Well, yeah.
I mean, basically right. What they're doing is they're manipulating the market. And if we did that here in the U.S., we'd say, hey, you know what, China? Listen, your clothes, really cheap. We appreciate that. But they fall apart. And by the way, they put American workers or North American workers out of jobs and out of their homes. So we're only going to allow you can import like 10 pairs of jeans a year, but not 20 pairs of jeans and no shirts. Well, that's manipulating the market.
Hey, everybody does that. They have restrictions on what can come into the country and why. Sometimes they do it to protect their business, et cetera. But Universal's had a lot of
I kind of wish we did do that. Is that just me?
Well, we do it a little bit. But Universal's had Oblivion, the Tom Cruise film, Jurassic Park 3D, and Les Mis. They all opened up this year, and Fast and Furious 6 is opening soon. So they're not getting every movie they want released.
No, it opened over the weekend. It opened.
Right. And so that's opened up in China, but Despicable Me 2 did not make the cut. And one reason is probably because they want to let their own films do better. It doesn't matter, though, because even if a movie plays in China, they don't get any money.
That's true, actually. You know, we kind of talked about this back in April after CinemaCon when we mentioned that Fox was refusing to accept payment for Life of Pi because of this new tax. Part of this agreement that China finally agreed to, even though they were supposed to agree to it in 2009 and only did so 3 years later, is they upped the percentage of the box office that a U.S. or foreign studio could take out of the country to 25%. That was the top limit. It used to be between 13 and 17, and now they're saying, okay, no, let's make it 25. But what they then did was they had this...
Added a big surtax and said, we'll take away all that extra money in an extra tax.
Right. They said, no, here's the thing. The VAT, the value-added tax, is going to be between 2 and 8%, and it's going to be taken after the split. So after the exhibitor takes their money... they're 75%, and after you take your 25%, studio.
Why don't say all these numbers?
Well,
yeah, I'm lost.
So basically,
they said you can get 25% of your movie gross, but guess what? We're going to tax you so much extra that you're not going to get any more money. So
right.
You're still going to end up with what you had before. But now people are fighting over who has to pay this tax. So the U.S. studios are saying, we're not accepting funding. We're not accepting this money until you agree to pay this tax because we're not paying it. That's not part of our agreement. And China's saying, you got to take the money. And now they're having big negotiations to figure out who gets to pay this tax. Is it the film group company in China? Is it some third party system? Is it the government or is it the U.S. companies? And until they do, no money's coming out of China. So movies are playing there like Fast and Furious 6 and others, but the money is staying, I guess, in a bank account somewhere. And they will resolve this at some point, and then the money will be released. But it's a big fight because China's trying to circumvent the agreement it made. It said, oh, we'll raise the amount you can take. And they gave it with one hand and took it back with another. And now the studio's trying to force them to stick to their agreement, and they're having a legal back and forth. So right now, if you have a movie in China, you're not getting any money out because you don't want to accept payment because that would... you've set a precedent that you agree you should pay this extra fee, and they don't want to do that. So they're going back and forth, and they'll come to an agreement at some point, and then the money will be released.
You know, between, and I'm writing something for Celluloid Junkie about this.
Oh, I wish you would.
And I'm really trying to, I don't know, a part of me wants to open the piece by talking about how, you know, when you're in high school and your best friend has a boyfriend or a girlfriend, and all they keep talking about is how much of a pain in the neck he or she is. You know, they're just not a good boyfriend or girlfriend, and they're high maintenance, and they cause all sorts of problems. And now what we find out is he or she isn't even putting out.
I think you should try and start the story in another way.
Note to self. But I mean, do you understand the analogy there? They're not even being paid by China. It's like China is so difficult to deal with for the studios, and yet they're not even being paid.
Well,
why
the money's
bother?
Being held, it will be released at some point. So it's
why
not that
bother?
They're not paying.
You can't make a movie and not release it in China these days. I mean,
well, only 34.
Well, sure,
regardless
you can
of what we have
money.
All just talked about. I mean, it's one of the fastest growing movie audiences there is. I mean, right?
But,
that's my understanding.
I disagree entirely. I would not release my big movie in China until I would able to take 50% out of the market, and they would open it up to more of my movies. I'd just say, screw you. You're not going to get to release my movie. I'm not going to support your theaters, let you learn and train and watch how I make movies by making movies in China like DreamWorks Animation is doing, let you learn all my state secrets, then block my movies and release your own films. I would say when I have a big movie you want to see, like The Avengers 2, I'd say, guess what? You want to show The Avengers 2? Then I get 50% of the box office. And if they say no, you say fine, because why do you care? It's an extra, you know, you're losing out on 20% of your box office or 15% from China. So what? Then they don't get to show the movie. The people get angry. They start to complain to their government and go, why don't we get to see these big Hollywood movies?
Well, and then they pirate
you're
it.
Playing, that's the, you're playing the,
yeah,
that's okay.
But try and explain that pirate. To shareholders.
The people are going to pirate it anyway. What shareholders? You're letting them screw you out of a ton of money. If you don't take a stand when you have a movie they want, when you have a little leverage, when you have the Avengers 2, China wants to screen that movie and show it in China. That's when you can actually make them do what you want. China should not have been let into the World Trade Organization until they started following the rules. That was the problem. They said, oh, we want China to follow these rules. We'll let them in, and then we'll convince them to do it. It's like, no, they really wanted to be part of the WTO. You have to say, uh-uh. You don't get in the gang until you start to follow the rules. Once you show you're willing to abide by international laws, then you get into the World Trade Organization, because that comes with a lot of benefits. They're getting all the benefits and none of the penalties. And that's what's happening with the U.S. companies in China. They're being fools. Oh, yeah, well, we have to have our movies in China, even though they only get 15% of the box office and China still taxes them. I don't understand it.
No, you're right. You're absolutely right.
No. Well, and so, come on. The girlfriend analogy? No.
You're tacky. You're tacky.
No. Okay.
If Karen had a boyfriend, I bet it wouldn't be so bad if he was George Clooney, who sure was pretty savvy about talking about Hollywood studios, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. Now, I guess that means you want to move on without talking about Jeffrey Katzenberg and Turbo.
Yeah. Who cares? Who cares?
Well, he said, well, okay, fine.
He said Turbo's going to be profitable. Yeah, well, we'll wait till the whole box office is in, but it sure doesn't look like it.
No, he said it fell short of expectations. He said, you know.
But he said, with worldwide box office, Turbo will be profitable. Okay. It doesn't look like it from the overseas grosses yet, but maybe he'll be right. We'll see when all is said and done.
Yeah, well, he says Katzenberg, yeah, as you said, I like the fact that he says that it will likely be a hit overseas, including markets where it will face less competition when it opens.
Well, now, he says he opened it at a bad time in North America. Too many other animated films, too many movies that did well, blah, blah, blah.
Right. Yeah. Well, I wonder if it will open in China, where he's like basically sent all of the work. We'll see. In any case, you wanted to talk about George Clooney, actor, director, producer extraordinaire?
No, you did.
Yeah, well, I find this incredibly
interesting. You've got a man crush on George Clooney.
Sure, if you wanna say that. But now, Karen, you've heard of this guy Daniel Loeb, right?
Yes.
Okay, so this is the activist investor, as he has, well, I guess, dubbed himself. He heads up a hedge fund, which is called Third Point. It manages $4.5 billion in assets. And earlier this year, they started buying up shares of Sony. And they have about 70 million shares, which account for 7% of the company's stock. And Loeb has been pressing Sony, the electronics company, the parent company of Sony Entertainment, Sony Pictures Entertainment, to sell off the entertainment division. He wants them to sell off Sony Pictures Entertainment and the record companies, because he says those divisions are bloated. And they are run poorly, they're mismanaged, and they spend too much money, and they're not good for the bottom line.
Well, he's saying that they've got a big, disastrous summer releases: After Earth, the Will Smith movie, White House Down. They're huge flops. He compares them to Waterworld and Ishtar. And George Clooney says, shut up.
Right. He's basically saying...
But he says shut up with some, you know,
class and
examples
charisma
behind it.
Yeah, and he had this interview with Deadline. And he says, I've been reading a lot about Daniel Loeb, a hedge
Don't
fund
read
guy.
The whole thing.
I'm not going to read the whole thing, but still, I probably should because it's so good. He says he's a hedge fund guy who describes himself as an activist, but who knows nothing about our business. And he's looking to take scalps at Sony because two movies in a row underperformed. When does the clock stop and start for him at Sony? Why didn't he include Skyfall, the 007 movie that grossed $1 billion, or Zero Dark Thirty, or Django Unchained? And you know, and what about the rest of the year that includes Elysium, Captain Phillips, and he goes on to mention all these movies? He says, you can't cherry pick a small time period and point to two films that didn't do great. It makes me crazy. And he just obliterates this guy.
He's smart. He's a smart guy. He sounds like he's running for office at one point. He says, hedge fund guys do not create jobs, and we do. On the movie we just made, we put 300 people to work every day. I'm talking about nice, regular people. And when we shot in a town, we put another 300 people to work. This is an industry that thrives. There are thousands of workers who make films. You want to see what happens if outside forces start to scare the industry and studios just to make tentpoles out of fear? You will see a lot of crap coming out.
Yeah, well, what I like is he's speaking of manipulating markets. He said, why is he buying stock like crazy if he's so down on things? He's trying to manipulate the market. And he goes on and on. And but here's the thing. You normally when there's a tirade like this, half the time you read it and go, oh, my God, this actor should probably stop talking. But with George Clooney, everything he says makes sense. You want him to keep going.
Yeah, it's one of those few times when an actor actually sounds smart.
Yeah.
It happens once in a while.
Once in a great while.
I wonder what George Clooney would say about CBS and Time Warner Cable.
Well, wait a second.
I've been in New York.
Wait a second. Before we move on, this is the... I'm just going to read the last line of what he says here. He says, and you talked about jobs, Michael. He says, it creates a lot of jobs and is still one of the largest exporters in the world, he said, of the entertainment industry. To have this guy portraying it that Sony management is the bad stepchild and doesn't know what it is doing and he's going to fix it, that is like Walmart saying, let me fix your town, putting in their store, strangling all the small shops, and getting everyone who worked in them to work for minimum wage with no health insurance.
George Clooney for president.
Yes, I'm voting for him on November, whatever the election day is. But anyway, you know who I'm not voting for is Time Warner. You're absolutely right. And I don't mean Time Warner. I mean Time Warner Cable, because Time Warner and Time Warner Cable are different. We had a big dispute about that, Karen, here on the show where all of our listeners.
Not a dispute. We were just wrong.
We were wrong. With
Karen,
a capital
W. How do you
W.
get your television? Do you get cable, satellite, or do you just go online?
I have Time Warner Cable.
Oh, so you're not getting CBS right now?
No, we're Showtime.
Do you subscribe to Showtime?
I don't. But see, because I work for a competitor, I get it all for free anyway.
What?
So you do get it. You get access to Showtime.
I get it, but not through Time Warner. No. So, right. And I kind of hope that they get their together, because I plan on watching NCIS Los Angeles, one of my new favorite shows, like in real time.
Oh, wow. Okay. Well, you're going to have a tough time, because as we know, there's this big dispute. And this happens all the time now. Time Warner Cable, being a multi-video program provider, MVP.
It's
a cable provider. They are saying to CBS, who's coming to them and saying, hey, you need a retransmission agreement to, you know, retransmit our signal, CBS or KCBS and WCBS and KCAL here in Los Angeles. And oh, by the way, Showtime, yes, you do need, you know, it's a premium. You definitely need an agreement for that, because that's not a must carry. And basically, they could not come to an agreement. Rumor has it, the scuttlebutt is that CBS is asking for $2 per month per subscriber from Time Warner Cable, which is a
lot.
How
much were they paying before?
It's
slightly less than a dollar.
Slightly less than a dollar from what we understand, although nobody really knows this
right.
Perfectly. Time Warner says, hey, they wanted a 600% increase in their retransmission agreement. And CBS is saying, you know what? Time Warner is being completely unreasonable. We did not want a 60% increase. We just want what our programming is worth.
I called Time Warner to pay my bill today. I wanted to get my balance. And the very first thing the voice said, CBS is being crazy. To learn more information, press 1. They have people calling saying, where's my CBS channel? And, you know, they got to deal with customers who don't care about who wants what. They just want to be able to turn on their TV and watch Under the Dome and whatever, the Dodgers if you're in LA, and whatever CBS show you get in your local market. And people aren't happy. They don't care. They say, I pay a lot of money for my cable bill. Why aren't you getting CBS?
Well,
but what Time Warner Cable is saying is that if they have to pay CBS what CBS wants, that then they're going to have to make their customers pay more in order to cover that.
That's correct.
Or have less profits.
Well, we all know that that's what it really means, but they're pretending like, well, we're saving you money because, you know, this is all ultimately going to come out of your pocket.
So they both look bad, but who gets hurt more? Is it CBS or Time Warner? I think people instinctively say, I hate cable companies. I think
the cable company definitely, I think, does. But, you know, I would think CBS losing that ad money, I don't know how that's going to work, because they, I guess, already have their ad money.
They have to have give backs and kickbacks and make dues, because they're not reaching the audience that they're supposed to.
That's right. They have make goods is what they call that, is when they have to say, well, we promised you 2 million people would watch the show. 1 million did. So we have to make good on the fact that, you know, we're 1 million short.
Right. But in terms of PR, it's always going to be the cable company that loses, because
plus
that's
it's,
what
it's the
understand.
Summer. And of course, the CBS has the biggest hit of the year right now, Under the Dome. It's one of the biggest new shows, period. Fall, spring, summer, you name it. But it is summertime, so most of their shows are reruns. And, you know, they've got what do they have? Survivor. They got Big Brother right now.
Big Brother, I mean, right now, which is big.
No pun intended.
Pardon the pun. What concerns me is whether CBS is going to, or either side, is going to hang with this until the fall TV premieres, and then you've got NCIS, which is one of the biggest shows on TV, and then that's when you seriously have leverage.
Well, yeah. also, what about football? That's the real leverage they have here.
That is the real leverage,
because that's something that you can't go, oh well, I'll time shift that. No, it happens in real time, and people are talking about it, and the game is over, and you get the score in the newspaper. So you pretty much have to watch that live, which is why live sports is so valuable.
And which is why DirecTV is grinning right now.
Right. But, I mean,
like CBS, the college football starts in less than 30 days. I'm in Birmingham, Alabama, and every day on the radio, they count down how many days until football starts. They're at day 26, working their way. They start counting at 100. That's how crazy they are about college football. And college football starts on Saturday, August 31st, and people are saying that and the NFL starts a week later, and people are saying this might stretch out until August, and that's when you'll really see people getting up in arms.
I think it will stretch out that long.
Yeah, and you have the analyst that we've come to know and love, Richard Greenfield over at BTIG. He is urging Time Warner Cable to dig in their heels, because quote unquote, this most likely means an extended multi-week blackout, as we just talked about, and that Time Warner Cable will have virtually no leverage in battles with other broadcasters that occur at the end of 2013, early 2014. Simply put, this is a once in a cable lifetime opportunity to battle retrans. And I would agree. I mean, I think that if you're CBS, if you're NBC, if you're ABC or Fox, you have deals with the FCC, and you either are a must carry or you are not. And you have
that's not an issue. No one's in there not legally allowed to ask for money yet, right? That's not the question. It's not whether they're allowed to ask for money. The question is what is a fair price to ask for?
Well, no, that's the thing. The FCC's must carry rules force these cable providers to deal with certain companies, including CBS. They can only deal. There's no competition. You can't say, well, I don't want CBS. I want this other one. You can't do that. And that's part of the problem. So really what CBS is doing here is saying, we want what's fair and reasonable for our product. But for decades, what was fair and reasonable was advertising. You got your FCC spectrum, you were broadcast over the air, you got a broadcasting license, and that allowed you to become this big, giant broadcaster.
Right, but now there are these big companies like Time Warner Cable and DirecTV, and they secondarily carry these shows that are available over the air. And they have these companies, they make billions of dollars off of carrying stuff that's available for free, and they get to charge their customers, $100 a month. And CBS says, hey, I want a cut of that. Well, right. I'm very valuable to you, and it's available for free over the air, but my God, you're making billions of dollars. I want my piece of the pie. Why am I less valuable than ESPN and something else? I get you more viewers than almost anything else that's on your entire cable spectrum. Why do I get the short end of the stick?
Because you also get a broadcasting license. So give the broadcasting license back. Then you're no longer a broadcaster, and you don't have to follow the broadcasting rules.
But that's CBS's choice.
Yes, that would be CBS's choice, not right. Time Warner's choice.
So, Karen, should Congress step in here? Should Congress say, wait a second, you're a broadcaster. You want that spectrum of over-the-air for free or for whatever limited amount you pay. Either you charge nothing and you just shut up and be happy that you're being carried on these cable channels, or you have to give back your license and just become a cable channel. Should they step in and stop this?
Somebody needs to. I mean, I think the oversight for this area is really lacking, and it's giving an awful lot of power to people who are taking advantage of it.
Well, the FCC is the group that oversees this, except they pretty much are biased at this point toward the.
They seem to be easily bought as well. So
yes, well, otherwise
calling them corrupt. Well, it's not. That's not the problem so much as the fact that Obama's had somebody up to take over, and they won't get appointed by Congress, right? Isn't it headless at the moment?
I believe so, yes.
I don't know. It's a good question.
The Jenikowski left, and I don't think anybody has taken his place yet.
Here's my question. Is there any reason why CBS shouldn't say, you know what, we don't need this broadcast license. Let's give it back and just become a cable channel. Then we don't have to deal with standards and practices. We can show whatever we want at 8 o'clock at night, and we can demand more money from the cable companies, because guess what? They're going to want NCIS and Under the Dome and SEC football. And who are they going to be missing out on?
Wait, but then does that mean that people have to pay money to CBS for like a whole separate package or something?
No, you're carried by cable companies will want to carry you, just like they carry ESPN and MTV. They're going to want CBS. And guess what? 91% of the people get cable or satellite. Another about 5% access CBS via Netflix or the CBS website or online. That means you're only talking about 3 or 4% of the people in the entire country who don't get TV, you know, who are getting it either via rabbit ears or God knows how, not at all. So almost everybody.
So you're saying CBS not to be in over the air.
Right.
Yeah. It's
because
yeah,
right now they're a must carry, which forces all these MVPDs, these cable companies, to carry the broadcaster and to carry CBS and NBC, any broadcaster that's a must carry, to carry.
I don't see where CBS would lose if they said that they only wanted to be cable now, because I don't have the numbers, but I would think few people actually get it over the air.
91% get cable or satellite. Another probably 4 or 5%, you know, everybody has slightly different numbers, but, you know, probably another 95% of people either have cable and satellite, or they just are cord cutters and never had a cord, and they access television via the web, you know, via Netflix or Hulu or CBS.com, where you can watch shows the next day. That's how they watch their TV, or their college students. So there's
and
only
the future is cord cutting anyway. So what is, you know, CBS doesn't need to be broadcast.
And the only people that don't get cable and satellite or via online access are really poor people or really old people that, you know, cable advertisers don't care about anyway, frankly.
That's a good point. What
would they be happy to slough off some of those 80-year-olds who have rabbit ears?
Yeah, they don't count for anything. The 80-year-olds.
Well, I think total
they don't.
Viewers.
Not in the eyes of people who are involved in the TV business. No, they don't count.
And in fact, they hurt them. And CBS might benefit a little bit by trimming off some of those numbers. I think every viewer counts, and I think they matter because people buy products until they're dead. But
especially because CBS is, don't they have like the oldest skewing?
Oh, yes. So they've come down. They've come down a bit. And they did win the 18 to 49 demo this season. They're the number one network in total viewers. They're the number one network in 1849. So take that, Fox, is what they say. Now, here's another question. If CBS did that, and we don't see any lose in this situation, if they gave it up and said, we'll be a cable channel, guess what? We'd have all this airwave and bandwidth to deal with. What would we do with it?
I think you could. I think you sell it or you auction it off.
We could create Birmingham Redux.
Right. That's right. And you could all, but remember, we've had this first responder problem all over the country, allowing first responders to communicate with each other. You know, the fire trucks and the policemen and the medical people. You know, you could create a national emergency thing for first responders. You could set up national Wi-Fi with this spectrum. You could save it for future innovation. You could lease it to people. You know what? It'd be a huge new source of revenue for the country. So it'd be a good thing for everybody. I think it's a win-win. I think CBS should say, you know what? To heck with it. We're not a broadcaster. We're a cable channel. What do they have to lose?
I'm sure there's something. I'm sure somebody would find something. You know, in other words,
we're missing something.
We're missing something here. Yeah.
And we can't be that smart.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, we can't.
Well, and as this article I found pointed out, and it was really just an aggregate of all of these studies on this subject, all of these regulations come from the Cable Act of 1992, which allowed must-carry channels to begin charging retransmission fees. And they started off at pennies, and they're now at $2. So, and I think $2 is probably low if that's accurate.
And of course, it's scary to change anything when your quarterly profits are a record high. CBS's corporation second quarter profits hit a record high behind licensing and distribution gains. For the quarter ending June 30th, CBS grossed $472 million or 76 cents a share. And that's a record.
Right. And and they earned a record amount actually in their affiliate, and $549 million, they gained 18% on their affiliate and subscription revenues. Well, guess what? This is affiliate and subscription revenues. This is what we're talking about here.
Right. This is separate from what I was just describing, the $472 million.
Right. Exactly.
Right. So there's another area where they're grossing in money. So yeah, that's $500 million where they're making money. So, you know, and also they'd give up so much red tape, I think, if they were not a broadcaster. I don't see where they'd be wrong. I think it'd be a really big deal if they did it. And if they did, I bet the other networks would follow suit.
You know, it was a really big deal. And I know you're trying to move us on to Big Deal or Big Whoop. What was a big deal to me is at Time Warner, because I'm a Time Warner cable customer too. I have no choice. I can't get, Verizon. They don't come here. I can't get AT&T. They don't come here. The only thing I could do is go and get a satellite dish, but then I wouldn't get cable. I mean, internet access. And so because I use Time Warner Cable as my internet access, and actually I use Earthlink, but it comes through Time Warner Cable. Despite that, Time Warner Cable on Friday had this notice on their on Channel 2, CBS, saying, hey, you can still watch CBS at CBS.com.
But then I saw that too.
And you can't.
And you can't, because when you go to CBS.com, they say, I'm sorry, but you use Time Warner Cable as an ISP, and we're kind of in a fight with them right now.
Yeah, you totally can't.
And that, I think, is is wrong and very well may be breaking a law. I don't know for sure. Probably isn't if they're doing it. But
that's like when you break up with your boyfriend and they say you can't go to the soda shop because they're going to be there too.
Well,
wait, I'm sorry, Spur. I'm trying to continue your ridiculous.
Breaking up with your boyfriend and I'm not putting out.
Okay, so maybe that wasn't the best analogy. I'll admit. Okay. Still.
It just tells us about your high school.
I'm sure my high school appreciates that. But no, I guess what I'm saying is I could very well be a rabbit ear television watcher, a cord cutter, and say I only want Time Warner Cable for the internet access. In which case, I've got no beef with this whole CBS thing. I don't watch CBS via Time Warner Cable anyway. But instead, Time Warner Cable is punishing me. Its customer, not Time Warner Cable, CBS is punishing me. A Time Warner Cable customer.
But you wouldn't be, if you weren't getting cable, they probably wouldn't do that. They would know that you were just getting Wi-Fi and say, welcome.
No, that's not true. That is not
true
at all.
How do you know that?
Because it doesn't matter. The signals
are
split.
They could know that you were just a Wi-Fi customer and not a cable customer. They would know. They would say, no way, you're there and you're actually just getting Wi-Fi. And therefore, you're not losing your cable thing. You're not part of this fight and you can get access to our website. I bet that's true. They know what you had for breakfast this morning. They can do that.
Well, yeah. Here's what I want to know. If the NSA really is recording everything, and including the show, by the way, if they really are doing that, does that mean I can stop backing up my hard drive?
Anyway, Karen has a meeting coming up, so we got to keep going on. Keep moving, keep moving.
Okay, so
we got to get to the record round, the speed round.
The speed round, which is usually longer than the rest of the show. So, yes, it is time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. And now we can play it the real way with two people.
Exactly, exactly. I'm so excited.
So here's our first story. The era of blockbuster album
Alaska.
Sales...
I'm sorry, I was just jumping the gun. I just wanted to try to get the answer in first.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, that has nothing to do with what we're about to talk about. But, you know, I know you always say this, Michael, that the era of blockbuster album sales ended a long time ago. Is the era of album sales coming to an end, too? That must be what it seems like in whatever record stores remain in the U.S. For the fourth week in a row, album sales for the entire country here in the United States, including physical CDs and digital downloads, have been less than 5 million copies. That's the worst streak since SoundScan started tracking actual album sales back in 1991. The last 2 weeks have been the lowest total album sales ever in that entire 22-year span. Is it streaming music? Is it the fact that record chains have all but disappeared and outlets like Walmart and Best Buy have shrinking floor space for albums? Is it Adele's fault for not releasing a new album yet? That very well could be. And is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
This is a really interesting question. I think this is probably a pretty big deal for the music industry. It certainly changes it.
Well, you know, that's what we cover here is really interesting questions. Michael, what do you think?
I think it's a big deal, too. I think it's sort of, you know, a big change happens, like record stores shut down and people stay in the habit of buying albums and they do it any way they can. They buy digital downloads, they buy physical CDs online at Amazon, but eventually a year later, 2 years later, they fall out of the habit. They don't see records around, they don't see record stores, and suddenly they just stop doing it. They get out of the habit. They'll buy the new Robin Thicke single, Blurred Outlines, because by God, it's the hit of the summer. But eventually, they get out of the habit of buying music, and that's what happened here, and that's the threat for books as well, and I think it's a really big deal. It's sort of the chickens coming home to roost. You know what? When there are no record stores left, people stop buying albums, and this is what, you know, they have to be scared of. People are just getting out of the habit.
Yeah, I mean, we're all going to have to start learning how to play piano if we want to hear music.
We'll get sheet music like Beck did on his last album.
That's right. Now, Sony just announced it is relaunching the TriStar label, and Tom Rothman, he of 20th Century Fox fame, Tom Rothman is going to be in charge. He'll have the power to make up to 4 movies a year, as well as developing TV shows and all sorts of different media. And Rothman will report directly to Michael Lynton, the chairman of Sony Entertainment, and Amy Pascal, the co-chair of Sony Pictures Entertainment. Rothman, of course, as I just mentioned, he left 20th Century Fox, I guess, last year when TV was being stripped from his domain. He was touted at one point as a potential head of Universal. He now looks like heir apparent to maybe Amy Pascal, his good friend. Is this a big deal or a big whoop? Michael.
Oh, no. Let Karen go first.
Karen.
But first of all, I just want to say I feel like I'm 100 years old because I totally remember when TriStar existed over at Sony.
That's exactly why I thought this story was important. I was like, oh, TriStar is coming back.
Yeah, I am 100 years old.
Where's Canon Films? That's what I want to know.
Carolco.
You want to know of what?
Canon
Where's
Films.
Canon Films? You know, Golden Globus, those crazy guys from the 80s. The go-go guys from the 80s.
Okay, I'm going to say that this the biggest deal here is that it shouldn't be happening, I guess. I don't understand why you need this. Why does Tom Rothman, who, as far as I know, wasn't really the creative guy.
No, he was the creative guy. In fact, he has very good relationships with most filmmakers. He's not, he's kind of a temperamental guy. Wasn't very much liked on the Fox lot and in town. You know,
Who is?
Tom Rothman. He can be, you know, tempestuous, I guess.
Okay, so he has the relationships, but do you need to bring in a production company that, you know, whether he has relationships or not, do you need to bring in this new production company and pay this guy probably a gazillion dollars and fund his movies, which are going to be very expensive, I'm sure, when you've got Amy Pascal? She has relationships too. So why do you need him?
Because Amy Pascal and Tom Rothman worked together long, long, long time ago in the late 1980s, and they're friends. That's why.
Yeah, she's doing her buddy a solid, and I actually think that this is kind of disgusting.
Michael, what do you think?
I thought Karen would say, man gets job, big whoop.
That's true.
I think it's a big whoop as well. So he gets to, I mean, it's not even clear. He gets to green light or not green light. How big can the budgets be? What level can he be? Is he just going to make something? If she hates it, he can make it anyway. He still has to report to Amy Pascal and the guy. So he sort of gets to make his up to four movies a year and make it happen. It just seems, all right, it's another shingle in a way. It's like a glorified producing deal. I just don't see the big point.
Yeah, well, and what's interesting is that everybody's saying very confused about this throughout town because they're saying, wait a second. Sony Pictures Entertainment and Sony, they were on a budget just last year. They were firing people and telling producer deals that, hey, we have to take some of this money back. So
if he had a really different perspective or talent field than Amy or the other people at Sony, like he was really good at art films or this was really good at action films or really good at animated films, if I understood what his purview was and what the point was for TriStar here, other than just making four more movies that he somehow gets excited about, I'm just not quite sure what the driving force is behind the idea.
Yeah, I tell you, he doesn't bring anything new to the table. To me, the biggest deal here is that the old boys club is alive and well.
Even when there were girls.
The biggest deal is that, yeah, there's a girl involved.
Wait, can I go back to my analogy?
No.
Okay. One of the executive producers of the Liev Schreiber hit series Ray Donovan over there on Showtime, which we can't watch anymore, could use Ray Donovan right about now. The character in the show, which has already been renewed for a second season, is a fixer for a law firm. Wait, the fixers I know, in any case. It may be too late anyway for Brian Zurif. He's already pled guilty to running an illegal gambling enterprise in L.A. and helping to run another one in New York that has mob ties and allegedly helped to launder illegal funds. It's called the entertainment industry. I'm sorry. Zurif faces up to 5 years in prison and has already forfeited $500,000. He's also stepped down from the show. Big deal or big whoop? Michael.
It seems to be a big whoop. I'm not even sure exactly what he did on the show. I don't think he's the showrunner. He wasn't the creator of the show. And frankly, I wish I knew who was the showrunner on a show. I know it's not an official title, but maybe it should be. Because when I look up a show, I want to know who's running this baby. And when I went to Ray Donovan to try and figure it out.
It is an official title, Michael.
It's an official title.
Yeah, it's like head writer.
I don't ever see it listed on IMDb. And I never see showrunner. You look on IMDb, tell me who's the showrunner on Ray Donovan. I don't see it. I wish it was.
It'll usually be the head writer, executive producer.
Yeah.
It says showrunner in the credits at the end of The Walking Dead. It will say showrunner Michael Giltz.
No, it'll be the executive producer.
Right. That's not. Then it doesn't say showrunner.
But BZ, as we all know him from back in the day, was definitely not a showrunner.
Wait, BZ, you know this guy?
Yeah.
What?
From what?
Oh, my God. He used to be one of my old bosses at William Morris, one of his best friends. When I heard about this, I was just like, hooray. I could not get enough. To me, this is a big deal, but only because personally, I'm just so happy to see this happen. I just love when bad news happens.
Wow.
Not a favorite boss of yours, I guess.
Well, no, it wasn't. But and to be fair to poor Brian Zurif, he was always a really, really nice guy. But I totally remember he would call and he would always be like, hey, it's busy. And I was like, wow, I couldn't even believe he even had this gig. I mean, it's just amazing. I can't get enough of this story.
Isn't he busy enough? I mean, he's got to run gambling enterprise. I can't even get one job going, and this guy is too.
I know, it's just, right? It's just, this is the big deal because it's just the best story ever.
Well, Michael, in all fairness, BZ, as he's known by his friends and relatives,
Or one not of, so friends.
Right. One of his jobs was illegal. It did land him in jail for 5 years.
That's true.
Yeah. Well, okay. Well, here's the deal. The New York Times is selling off the newspaper, the Boston Globe, for $70 million. That's a huge loss from the $1.1 billion the New York Times paid for the paper back in 1993.
Whoops.
Talk about depreciation. My goodness. And the Times will still be on the hook for $110 million in pension liability. Since the Times bought the Globe, its circulation has dropped in half from about 500,000 to 250,000. I'd say, is this a big deal or a big whoop, but it's kind of a big deal in my opinion. Karen, what do you think?
Yeah, it's definitely a big deal.
Michael?
It's a big deal because it shows how much newspapers have collapsed. Even a name brand like the Boston Globe in a major market. My God, New York Times is saying, we will pay somebody $40 million to take this off our hands because they owe $110 million in pension liabilities, and they're only getting set. So they're saying, we will pay $40 million. I would have taken $40 million to take this off their hands. I mean, it's unbelievable. It's a sad, depressing fact that not even a paper as established as the Boston Globe, the leader in their market, can survive in any real way. The only way it survives is if somebody takes it on as a hobby. It's a wealthy man who owns the Boston Red Sox, and now people are worried, how will they be covered now that this guy owns the paper and the team? How, you know, he just has to say, this is my hobby. I'm going to pick up a library or a newspaper and keep it going. Otherwise, it would collapse.
Wow. Well, you know, how are the Red Sox covered now? They're probably despised.
They're covered great because they're in first place.
Yeah, exactly. Well, here's a question for you. Can Tobey Maguire sing? And here's why. Because the Broadway musical, and you know, Karen, we had to do this. Spider-Man, turn off the dark. It finally needs a new leading man. The stalwart Reeve Carney has stuck with the troubled but, of course, long-running show. It's been like 2.5 years, right? Two to three years. Well, for about 3 years, it says here, and he's stepping aside. No word yet on whether his rock band, which I believe is named Carney, will pick up and try to capitalize on his newfound status, or whether that Jeff Buckley biopic will get off the ground. In any case, he's leaving on September 15th, just a few weeks short of the show hitting 1,000 performances after it opened. That's a lot of performances. The producers will hold a major casting call to try and dig up some new talent to fill the leotard. Get it? Because he's in a loop. Anyway, big deal or big whoop, Michael?
It's a big whoop. You know, the show's been running for over two years now. They don't count preview performances when they talk about 1,000. It only starts once you actually open. This show had the longest preview in history, Broadway history, over 6 months of previews. So it would already be one of the top 100 running films. It would already be one of the 100 longest running shows in Broadway history if it had opened up on time. But it's going to be there in a few weeks, and that's the big deal here, that this show is still on the board and still losing money. They've still got a long ways to go before they actually get into the black, but by God, it's lasted a long time.
Karen?
Yeah, a big whoop. Man leaves job, new man's going to get job.
And it ain't us.
That's right. The Department of Justice won its case against Apple. Yes, we already talked about that. But will it win its fight to change the way Apple does business? In its filings with the court, the DOJ, as it's known here in the U.S., is demanding that Apple stay out of the agency business for 5 years when it comes to publishing. That won't be difficult since it already forced publishers to change how they do business. But among other restrictions, it wants to force Apple to allow third-party companies to sell products and services via apps without Apple getting its customary 30% cut. Hold on, I'm just looking out the window to see if that was a donkey flying by. Nope, not a donkey. Nope, nor is that a chicken with lips. So this isn't going to happen. That would be a radical change, and Apple is fighting back, of course. They say the final order for relief is draconian and has nothing to do with the issues at hand, which I would have to agree with. Apple says they did nothing wrong, but the practice has ended anyway and won't begin again given the settlement with publishers. So why is the DOJ messing with how they do business? Leave us alone, they say. Big deal or big whoop, Michael?
Michael, again, I would say it's a big whoop until it actually gets settled, but the DOJ has won every step of the way when I thought they would lose. So if they win this, then it becomes a big deal because this would be a radical change.
Okay, no, I'm glad actually that Sperling went to you first because this is sort of over my head, a lot of this. I would say this is a big deal because anytime that the DOJ is going to get involved in this kind of thing, to me, is a pretty big deal.
And it's bizarre. Like, what does this have to do with anything? The way the App Store runs.
That's what confuses me, I think. I'm like, what? How does this affect me? Why am I supposed to care? What's going on?
But, you know, I've been with Apple every step of the way thinking they had the better case, that it was a bad case, that they wouldn't win. The judge seemed to get convinced and they lost every step of the way. So I wouldn't rest easy if I were them. They might well lose this.
Holograms have been used to bring pop stars back from the dead. Iconic figures like Frank Sinatra and Elvis Presley. And of course,
and Tupac.
Yes, over at Coachella. Now the wildly popular Korean pop industry is hoping to use holograms to take their K-pop boy and girl bands to the next level. Instead of touring their acts, which is so 2005, they plan to open some virtual concert centers and have holograms of their biggest acts perform virtually around the world in far-flung locations all at the same time. They can also record holograms and turn these V theaters into tourist attractions. Heaven forbid anybody does this with Justin Bieber. I will have to hire a lawyer. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
I guess this doesn't become a big deal until and unless it becomes really successful. Right now, it's just sort of a head scratcher.
Michael?
And it will never become successful because it's idiotic.
Okay.
But definitely the nice bizarre, thing is, right?
It's just stupid. It's like, it's ridiculous. People don't go to a concert to see an image. That's called, you know, watching TV. They go to see the act. And if you want to be in the same room as Teen Pop, the biggest K-pop band right now, and I want to see Teen Pop live. I don't want to see images
of
them.
Teen Pop? They really are?
This is a six-member boy band. It's whatever. It's the latest, hottest K-pop.
Oh, my God.
It's
so awesome.
And the girl band that I saw on CNET, which has this story, they actually had a YouTube video. And there's all these people. There's hundreds, if not thousands of people watching this virtual concert, all with their cameras and their phones up taking pictures.
Oh my God.
And I was like, wait a second, you're taking pictures of a picture. Not only that, but then the band came out to say hello and then walked off stage and the virtual concert continued. All I could think of is, wait a second, you're right there. Take the screen down and start performing.
Stop being so lazy.
Exactly.
How did you enjoy our hologram? Teen Top, though, does sound very pervy. But anyway.
Oh, my goodness. Well, Art Bell, you know, if you listen to the radio late at night, especially while on the highway and multi-channel surfing, chances are you've heard the Oddball Show coast to coast at some point. From 1984 to 2003, it was hosted by Art Bell, who made it a huge success thanks to his unerring combination of genuine scientists and, you know, scientists of stature some nights, alongside nut job UFO experts and callers who would claim to be time travelers on other nights. You'd never know whether you'd hear an interesting and informed discussion of black holes or tales of unicorns and alternate realities. Bell semi-retired and then retired for good about 6 years ago, though the show lives on. Now he's returning to the airwaves with a show called Dark Matters on Sirius in September, and that's Sirius XM, actually, since everybody seems to be merging these days. It's sure to continue his distinctive, never-duplicated style. Big deal or big what, Michael?
Always starting with me first. You're so rude. I would say this is a big deal because Art Bell, I loved his show. It was, my dad loved it a lot. It's a crazy nutty show. I wouldn't listen to it at home, but if you're on the highway, you could depend on Art Bell for just some nutty, nutty times. You know, he'd listen to people, and when he decided that they really weren't time travelers, he'd hang up on them. I'm like, you could have hung up when they called up and said, I'm a time traveler. But anyway.
The first thing I'd ask a time traveler is, how is the crucifixion?
Yes, exactly. Very crowded would be the answer if time travel were possible. However, the big thing here is this is like Howard Stern coming back to radio if he had left the airwaves for good for 5 or 6 years. So he's a big personality in radio. He pioneered this very different format. It's still going strong, and he's a welcome return.
Karen.
Big deal. Who the hell is Art Bell?
Wait. You mean Big Whoop?
Big Whoop. Sorry, Big Whoop. Who the hell is Art Bell?
I just told you.
And she's rhyming, too. Did you notice she's become a poet?
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
She's a rapper.
I didn't even know I was one.
The BBC has just named, that's right, the new Doctor.
Yay!
Yay!
Doctor Who? Exactly. Doctor Who! The long-running character has been played by 11 official actors, and now the 12th lucky fellow was just named in a live TV broadcast. The winner is actor Peter Capaldi, a 55-year-old Scottish actor whose most acclaimed role is in the political satire The Thick of It. Now he's taking on a role as iconic as James Bond and Superman in the eyes of many Brits and an increasing number of American fans as well. Capaldi will be handed the sonic screwdriver in a special holiday airing. I guess the Christmas show will be when he takes over, and I wonder if there will be subtitles since, you know, Scottish accents are sometimes hard to understand. Karen, big deal or big whoop?
Big whoop. He's what, the 12th Doctor Who?
I thought you had nerd friends, gay male nerd friends. Are you sure you do?
Oh, don't get me wrong. This was a huge deal on like Friday and Saturday when BBC America announced that they were going to say who the new doctor was on Sunday. So this was a big deal on Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And then all the nerd people that I know who care about Doctor Who are tired of talking about this guy, although they like the choice. But there's a new doctor all the time. So just naming a new doctor, I mean, ultimately, it's just man gets job, right?
There are 12 Doctor Who's in 55 years. That's not exactly all the time. 12 in 50 years. That's, you know, plus it doesn't even count John Hurt, who's playing the doctor in a holiday special coming up in October or November. And he's not really the doctor, but he is. But anyway, I think it's a big whoop as well. Not because I don't like the choice of Peter Capaldi. I do. He's in The Thick of It, which is a British political satire. Check out that show. It ran for 4 seasons. It's very funny, very scalding. The best show of its type since Yes, Minister, which was a British sitcom many, many years ago.
Actually, I believe it was Yes, Prime Minister.
Well, it's both. Yes, Minister was the original. Yes, Prime Minister was the sequel. You are wrong. Anyway, but I think it's a big whoop. I think it's a big whoop because they really had a chance here to expand the doctor. We've had Alex Kingston, who would have made a great doctor. She's been playing River on the show. She would have made a great doctor. The doctor could be a woman. The doctor could be a person of color.
Would be a big deal.
And they have not done that yet. I think they're going to do it. They're very close to doing it. I'm very excited for Peter Capaldi, but someday they're going to do that. And that will really be genre breaking. And I can't wait to see it when it happens. But he's a talented actor, and I look forward to seeing what he does.
Yeah, he's a good choice.
Does Doctor Who take insurance? Because I can't see him otherwise.
What?
This is a health insurance.
That was a really dumb joke. That was a dumb joke.
Yes, but it's a health insurance.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
It's a timely joke, no?
Keep going.
Oh, brother.
That's retardus.
Well, speaking of making...
don't say retarded. That's
yes.
Terrible.
I said retardus.
Oh, God.
That was funny.
Okay. Well, speaking
I
of
love
making,
number 11. Keep going.
Well, we're going to have to skip it because we're running out of time.
I hate you.
I thought you just hated my jokes. In any case, speaking of making history, the Oscars made history. They made history this past week. And the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Science made history when they named the new president of the Academy. She's the third woman to hold the position and the first African-American woman. A notable step for an industry where black figures are still solely absent in top positions at major studios and in director's chairs on sets. Cheryl Boone recognizes the significance of her earning that slot, but also knows she can hit the ground running with her years of experience on the board. Among her top priorities, the Academy Awards show, which is, of course, a major fundraiser and the most visible element in the Academy's year-round activities. Just as she came on board, they announced Ellen DeGeneres will be hosting the Oscars for the second time. I guess she hosted back in 2007. Michael, big deal or big whoop?
Ladies first. Is that insulting?
No.
It's retardus.
It's retardus. I think that ultimately this is a big whoop because it's two women get jobs. As far as how big a deal this is for the African-American community, I'm actually not really sure. I mean, I suppose it is, but... it's not like she's becoming president of the United States, you know?
Well, you know, just because one guy landed on the moon, now nobody can land on the moon. It's never a big deal now.
I think it's a big deal. Every barrier that falls is an important one when the person is good and they do the good job or they do a bad job. As long as they get a shot at a chance to do well and are given a proper chance to do so, you know, it's important. It's useful. It matters in an industry that lags so far behind. And they're really trying to make up for it by bringing in new people into the Academy, new voters. And I think this move is not just symbolic, but significant. And hopefully she'll do a good job and keep changing things going.
You know, maybe Twitter isn't such a bad promotional tool after all, as we kind of had called it on our last episode. The campy sci-fi TV movie Sharknado, or as we like to call it, Sharknado, was notable mostly for the number of tweets it inspired, which seemed to amount to one for every viewer. The social media hit actually drew only 1.4 million eyeballs when it originally aired, as we mentioned on episode 199. Then Sharknado aired a second time, and viewership jumped to 1.9 million viewers for the second airing. Then it aired a third time, and viewership jumped again. 2.1 million viewers watched the third time. Will Sharknado air a fourth time? Are you kidding? Of course it will. And is this a big deal or a big whoop, Karen?
Well, first of all, I can't believe that you guys think that Twitter is not a useful promotional tool.
I know. Who were you? How could you?
I think that this is a perfect example of the fact that it is. It just depends on what you're promoting. Sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. Do I think this is a big deal or a big whoop? I mean, ultimately, I think it's a big whoop.
Michael?
Well, we didn't say it wasn't a big deal as a promotional tool as such. What we said was the fact that people reported this movie, it didn't get good ratings. It made so-so ratings. And they said, oh my God, all these people talked about it on Twitter. Who cares?
Yeah, it didn't lead to big ratings. But it did lead to a second airing, probably a third or fourth, and it led to midnight movies. I mean, it's going to be a
flop as a midnight movie. And I would say if they air it 10 more times, it might start to equal what an actual network show makes in a regular viewing. 2.1 million viewers still isn't very much. It's only a lot by sci-fi numbers.
Well, so but it is, though, for network numbers these days, actually.
Well, if a network gets two, if a show gets 2 million viewers on one of the big four, it gets canceled.
That's true. On one of the big four. But of course, then you'd have to be a must-carry broadcaster. Well, that kind of concludes Big Deal or Big Whoop for this week. I know, Karen, you have to run off. Is there anything that you would like to plug?
Just follow me on Twitter, Karen_Woodward. It's always a pleasure to hang out with you guys.
We're so much better looking when you're around.
Aw, shucks.
I can tell she's blushing.
Well, thanks, Karen. We'll see you soon.
Thanks, guys. Invite me again.
Talk to you soon.
Bye.
Bye.
Now we can really say goodbye. Goodbye, Karen. She just hung up. She has to get to her meeting. Oh, well. Sometimes we on the air, we say goodbye, and then we pause the show, and then we actually say goodbye. They say, thanks for coming. They say, oh, you're welcome.
And then they tell us like
Oh, hey, we'll talk to you soon. Thanks a lot for the show. You know.
Yeah, they tell us like all the really good, juicy stuff that they can't say on the air.
And Karen said, click.
Yes. Bye. Click. Yes.
Because she's late for her meeting because of us.
That's true. Yes. And, you know, she's actually got like, you know, real work in the industry where she,
I remember those days.
Yeah. Well, she probably,
I remember when I landed my first freelance gig.
Did you have to go out and buy all new equipment?
I did, actually.
See, so they're not so far off that Samsung Best Buy ad, are they?
Nope.
Exactly. Well, it is time for Inside Baseball, where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing. We'll explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect you. This week, we have Amy Mann.
And I love Amy Mann.
She is effectively saying, hey, I'm going to sue you or something like that.
Well, she's saying exactly. She is suing. It's another week, another story about digital music and licensing and artist royalties. Let's see if we can lay this out clearly for you before discussing what it means. All right, here's the deal. There's a company called MediaNet. They were founded in 1999, and now basically they're a backroom facilitator for digital music. You've got all these online websites that play music and online radio stations, and each one does not go out and license music for all the music that they play. They find somebody who has like a blanket license, and they arrange to have it all cleared so they can play one person, and that person can pay all the different labels. That way, it's sort of an easy way, one-stop shopping for you. They provide a service to you. They provide a service for the publishers and the record labels, and everybody's happy.
It's a clearinghouse, an aggregator.
That's right. So they license more than 22 million songs to at least 40 music services like Yahoo Music, Playlist.com, eBay. I'm not sure how eBay music comes on eBay, but I guess it does. And numerous online radio stations. Now, unlike Spotify and Pandora, those dozens of companies have not directly licensed music from all the record labels. They've gone to MediaNet, which has already made those deals and has the right to license out these millions of songs for digital play. Or at least that's what they said.
Right.
Artist Amy Mann, who was, of course, Until Tuesday and has an acclaimed Oscar and Grammy-nominated solo career. I've seen her many times. I like her. She struck a deal with MediaNet in 2003. It ran through 2006 and had automatic two-year extensions unless one party canceled the deal. And that's exactly what she did. She canceled her deal with MediaNet in 2005. That's 8 years ago, presumably giving due notice before the actual expiration of the original deal in 2006. She's not been paid any royalties since September 30th, 2005, except for $20 that they sent her this past March, which she sent back without accepting. That didn't stop MediaNet from licensing her music and according to Amy Mann, inducing its business partners to commit copyright infringement. She is demanding statutory damages for willful copyright infringement of some 120 songs. That's a big chunk of her library. And she says damages could amount to as high as $18 million. This isn't the first time MediaNet has faced a lawsuit like this. In 2008, they faced a class action lawsuit from the Harry Fox Agency, which was an entity created to do much the same that they do. That was settled. Another lawsuit came from publishers in 2011, and a lawyer involved in that case claimed that sworn testimony revealed back in 2011 that almost 25% of their entire catalog was unlicensed, meaning they didn't have the rights to license it out to other people.
So basically, now, they're selling something they don't even have.
They don't own. And Amy Mann says, hey, I canceled my deal in 2005. You've been making money for the last 8 years when I told you it's over. And now a lawyer involved in her case says, quote, not only does this case seek redress for Amy Mann against one of the world's largest but least known providers of online music, it also serves as a call to other artists to follow the lead set by Radiohead and Pink Floyd to put an end to the unlicensed, uncompensated use of their music by online services. So what does this all mean, Sperling? Is it important? Is it useful? You know, who knew this was going on?
You know, I certainly knew that there were clearinghouses like this. I didn't necessarily know what their business was. I think, frankly, if they're licensing music that they do not have the rights to, well, that's wrong. So, I mean, I could
That's no different. That's no difference from, what was the Pirate Bay, the original one?
Napster?
Napster, yeah, it sounds like Napster. Well, except they're making money off it. Napster was just free.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I'm trying to think, like, you know, ultimately, if this case goes through, I thought it was kind of a much bigger deal than it is. It's really, for her, it'll be a big deal. And, you know,
but
I don't think it's
a quarter of their business could be illegal.
Well, here's the thing: if she wins her case, or if they settle, will they stop doing it? And something tells me that since it's not class action and it has nothing to do with, you know, criminal court or, you know, it's basically one individual suing this company, they'll still keep licensing music they don't own.
She's taking this case, she's being public about it, that brings attention to it. And other artists go, hey, wait a second, are they licensing my music? And they start to look into it, right? That's how this happens.
Right.
Somebody files a class action lawsuit. I mean, they're shining a spotlight, and this is like one of numerous times it's happened, and this company's been accused of illegal action, and, you know, it keeps happening and more attention. And if she wins her case, other people will step forward, I assume.
Right. And that is why this news is important, is because it is shining light on MediaNet, and it will make others say, well, wait a second, are they licensing my music? I don't know about that.
There must be some competitors for this company, right? I mean, they've got 22 million songs. That's a lot of songs.
That is a lot of songs.
There must be other online clearinghouses of this sort. I just don't know their names. I don't know who they are. I don't know who's the leader in the market. Is MediaNet the dominant one? They've got some big players, obviously.
Right. And I'd have to research that myself.
So this is something that more than one company is probably doing. It's very complicated to set it up and to get all the licenses and make sure you have the right to do all this stuff. And all these contracts come in and out and fall out of favor and, you know, lapse or get renewed automatically, all this sort of stuff. But in this case, it sounds pretty clear that she, you know, quit it 8 years ago. And I love how people take forever. This happens again and again. Somebody's on Happy Days and they say, hey, I haven't received a royalty statement for 20 years. And you say, well, where was your lawyer? Why weren't they asking why there was no statement coming from the studio about, you know, payments for royalties for the syndication of Happy Days? And these things seem to fall by the wayside because there's so many moving parts to a career like this. Amy Mann's got a lot to do. She's got an online website. She's touring. She's got her own record label. And it probably fell through the cracks. They didn't realize that these people were still using their songs and making money off of them.
You know, I'm working with a group right now that is putting on live performances in movie theaters. So concerts in movie theaters. And you want to talk about moving parts. It's, you know, there's riders and, you know, performance fees and performance contracts and music
and how much you get when it gets rebroadcast, but it's not live.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I looked at it
online.
What do you
get paid if it gets released on DVD? Does the people who hosted the live performance get a cut of that? No, they don't. Blah, blah, blah.
Right, exactly. And on and on. And then you're singing a song. Who wrote the song?
Oh, yeah.
You have to license the song. It's just, I kind of went, you know what? So many people have their hands out here that it's almost impossible to do business.
That's why I only sing my own songs or Stephen Foster music.
Okay, well,
because it's in the public domain.
All right, well, that kind of wraps up our 200th episode. So thank you, Karen Woodward, for joining us. I know she's not with us right now. Michael, thank you.
Thank you, fans, for joining us.
That's true. Actually, yes. Biggest thank you to all of our listeners who, of course, usually subscribe to us in iTunes or the Microsoft Marketplace, as I now know it's called, or Stitcher. iTunes, though, seems to be pretty popular. And if you can subscribe to us, we appreciate it. If you can rate and review us in any one of those podcast aggregators, it really does help us out. You can find our podcast anywhere they give out podcasts for free. You can also follow us. We have a Twitter account, which is twitter.com/showbizsandbox. We're also on Facebook. You can like us there. Just look up Showbiz Sandbox. Links to all of the stories we discussed on today's show can be found on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's also where you'll find all those ways to follow us and like us and subscribe to us and ways to email us. We don't have enough time today to go over all the email. We'll do that next week. You can email us dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. Or you can leave us a voicemail. The voicemail number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, all of this information is on our website, showbizsandbox.com. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. They can be found on MySpace or on their website, who is MGMT.com. They have an album coming out. They're on tour. Where are they this week?
Support them.
Yeah, I think, they're not anywhere this week, but on August 24th, they're going to be in Monterey, California at the Monterey County Fairgrounds, and then on August 25th, right here in Los Angeles at the FYE Festival.
I'm sure you'll be going backstage to see our friends.
Yes, to let them know what a wonderful song they have that
we've been using with fair use for so many years.
Yes, exactly. They very well might appreciate that. Michael, you have a website. Why don't you tell us what your website is this week?
MarryMeKarenWoodward.com.
Wow, that's a pretty big website. Or we can find you and some of your work at MichaelGiltz.com.
You can also find me at BookFilter.com. And thanks again to all the people who've been coming there and signing up to be members and leaving comments. I really appreciate it. It's great to get your feedback.
Some of my work can be found on CelluloidJunkie.com, where apparently I will not be making a pun about high school girlfriends putting out. Until next week, play nice.